I'm going to talk about a project, more of a prototype really, that I've been conducting called ALP, and whose goal is to be a different build system, maybe one that's more modular, more composable, and that plugs into existing ecosystems for various reasons I'm going to talk about. So first, I'm a big fan of Nix, and I've been a big fan of Nix for many years. I've started using Nix in 2015. I, back in the day, wrote a cargo to Nix compiler called CarNix at the time. Now it's been rewritten as Crate to Nix to compile crates independently when you do Rust. Before that, compiling a Rust project with many dependencies would take hours. I started a Nix-based CI system really early on back in the day for my version control system in 2017. And I haven't contributed much to Nix, unfortunately. I've written some Nix packages, some packages in Nix packages, including exotic stuff. I've recently fixed a few security issues like TLS checks or macOS sandboxing. Well, it's not fixed, but it's as good as a fix as there can be. And I'm currently running all my infra on Nix, not Lix, unfortunately, not yet at least. And I'm running several servers for different services online with Nix, and it's really cool and it works. And what I particularly like about it is that, you all know about that, right? It gives you a purely functional Turing-complete language to describe packages. But more fundamentally, it's a nicer way to create bash scripts, which are obviously a pain to write. So Nix just gives you a nice way to do that, and then you run them in isolation containers. And that's all really cool. And one thing that I liked as well, the reason I'm telling you all that is, I'm sure you guys are all agree with that, well, possibly not, but probably, is because I wanted to extract the few properties I really liked about the system I was using. So one is it gives you a smooth transition from compiling your own code to contributing packages. And that's also what explains the success of Nix packages. And there's so many contributions we're seeing compared to, for example, distribution like Debian, where everybody can contribute as soon as you can write your own packages, which not many people can do. And yeah, one of the biggest achievements of this community is obviously Nix packages, which is sort of like the Arch wiki, but at a much larger scale and formalized. So it's really a massive achievement for like the software community as a whole. And so what do I not like about all this, and what's the catch? So I said Turing completeness, something I liked, but actually that's kind of a lie. Turing completeness makes it easy to hide things, and it also means that nobody is really liable, and you don't really see Nix packages distributions. Like there can be a Red Hat Enterprise Linux where people transfer liability to insurance contractors, for example, in case you're attacked, if you have security issues. In Nix, this would be really hard to do because, well, there's this giant thing. Everything depends on everything else, and it's Turing complete. So in the end, being able to tell for certain what it does is not easy. There's no central governance, which is at the same time a good property, but also in a large organization where you want to use Nix, all your engineers might be using slightly incompatible extensions. And Flakes make that particularly easy because you can it helps fragment the ecosystem into tons of little libraries with their own dependencies. And one particular concern I've been facing in real-world projects is security, and especially security audits, and especially in the context of the defense industry. And in that case, security auditors don't really know what to look at when they see a giant Nix code base. And so they're like, okay, should we audit the Nix, this weird language that we don't really know what it does because it's purely functional, sure, but there's just no type. It's also lazy. The syntax is weird. We don't really know. There's this dual scope thing where the type can change when you have new variables in the scope. I'm specifically referring to the with syntax construct here. And so it seems the most reasonable option is to audit the bash code that's vomited by Nix, but that's not an option either because it's big and it's bash. And another thing is this gives you a feeling of supply chain security, because sure, it's all reproducible and you can audit it all, and it's fully deterministic and it's specified in this cool language that's purely functional. But also, you don't really know how your code is compiled, and I'll give you a few examples afterwards. And so, as this feeling of fake supply chain security, and I've seen people question it and debate it by with like two sides of the argument. One was like, no, Nix is good. Look, I found this blog post by, don't remember who wrote that, but I found this blog post saying it's really easy to extract an S-bomb from a Nix expression. And so this means it solves all your supply chain security issues. And then security people will be like, no, that's not really how it works. And we're familiar with this list of systems, and we know they're audited, and we can rely on their audits. And here we can't. So there seems this mismatch between what security folks expect and what the community is supplying. And also, so the poor language design I found, and also implementation, because the implementation is not much better. I hope you guys do a much better job. I haven't looked at the Lix code base, but I would trust you on that, like, obviously. I found, like, in my experience, and maybe it's not yours, maybe it's completely different, I don't know. But in my experience, this poor language design tends to favor the most toxic people in organizations, because I've seen people use the weird syntax and the hard to learn properties of Nix as an excuse to get the power and become essential to the organization. Try to get a promotion by being the Nix guy in the office, or the Nix guy in the Nix team, and just make things obfuscate things as much as possible. And Nix makes that very easy. One thing, for example, that stands in stark contrast with that is what Rust was doing about 10 years ago, when they were like, okay, running a Rust obfuscation contest to try and avoid constructs that favored obfuscation. So it seems Nix is kind of doing the opposite here. So in larger organization, by the language, so what you want here is the dream of using Nix in a large organization is that onboarding is basically free. Like, people can just get onboarded into any project at any time in 5 minutes. They just do Nix develop or Nix shell or whatever. And then they get right into it. They get the right dependencies with the right versions, and they don't have anything else to do. So that's really cool. And it works to a fair extent, I'd say. But unfortunately, by onboarding so many casual users or like non-Nix experts onto your systems, you're running into, and especially if you have a smart crowd of engineers, which many companies have, the problem is they're just like, nah, I'm not learning this thing. I'm not interested. Okay, yeah, there's this guy who told me Nix is the next best, like the next big thing, but I'm not interested. You know, like, I just want to do my work, write code. I don't really care how it compiles. Okay, but to pass CI, I'll just do a quick and dirty fix. And quick and dirty fix and compilation don't always work well together, especially again in a really like restricted security context. It favors the creation of a Nix team, which is, in my opinion, and like, feel free to disagree, obviously, but in my opinion, the creation of a Nix team in an organization is a bit weird, because Nix. The goal of Nix should be, I think, to turn everybody into a sysadmin expert, or something like that, or something like it should favor experiments and people just trying to compile stuff risk-free, because it all runs in containers and they cannot possibly make any mistake. And that's the good bit about functional programming languages, and it's the good thing about Nix as well. It turns everybody into someone who can do sysadmin and building. And so having a Nix team kind of defeats that point, because like, they're the experts, and everybody every time you run into a problem, you're gonna get to the Slack and reach out for the Nix team, the Nix experts who can fix your problem. And then so you're not learning, and it doesn't improve the first point. Then I've witnessed also practice I called frameworking, which is the creation of an internal framework to officially unify practices and flake dependencies and tell what flakes are good and what flake dependencies you should use, etc. And I tend to think that this is not great. Like unifying practices, of course, is a good thing, but then it tends to people teaching you how to compile your code. And sometimes, well, the experts in compiling their code are the people who write the code. Sometimes not, but many times, yes. Especially if you use weird stuff like, you know, CUDA, or many companies do AI these days, right? So they tend to run weird CUDA pipelines on unsupported boards, for example, IoT and whatnot. So here you want to let people use their Nix packages and like do their own overrides and do the freedom they're used to when they first learn Rust, Nix. And especially you want them to be able to find help on the forums. And finally, build speed. So this has been mentioned in the previous talk. Build speed is definitely a thing, and it doesn't really matter on your own machine. It can become a bottleneck in large-ish projects, and I've seen it have consequences, like actual problematic consequences in the real world. I cannot say that. Yeah, and legal consequences as well. Let's not give the details here. And when combined with Git and merge requests, so obviously a conflict of interest here, like I wrote something that's better than Git. So obviously there's a reason I wrote it, is because I'm not satisfied with what Git does. And so, yeah, so sometimes when you do, when your CI becomes so slow that it's a bottleneck, you have all your engineers compete for the first opportunity to rebase and get their stuff past CI and merge. And this can give rise to a situation where everybody is just clicking rebase on their GitLab all the time, waiting for the other CI pipelines to pass. And if, like, I'm talking like 2 hours CI here. And if you have a really busy project, it can give rise to interesting situations where code gets merged without passing the test, for example, because of GitLab fantastic idea of merge trains. And this also can have pretty bad consequences in the real world. Anyway, so one thing I loved but don't like so much anymore is to have fixed points everywhere. So fixed points are cool because they give you the feeling of being smart because you understand them. I'm not talking you, I'm talking me. Like we all love fixed points. Like when you have like a really, really carefully crafted fixed point, for example, the module system. When you really finally master the module system in Xpackages, you're like, yeah, this is really awesome, and I understand it, and I'm like, and and it's cool, and it's a good property, and cool languages should teach you stuff. So definitely, this is cool. But unfortunately, when you're doing that for system security, you run into the problem that since everything depends on everything else, any tiny change somewhere can force you to redo your security audits from scratch, or find ways to like hack your way around that. But that's complicated. To my knowledge, nobody's done it before. Every single bash script you can depend on everything else potentially. So that's like curl package, for example. Type checking, fixed points are cool, but they also defeat the point of type checking, because it's almost impossible to build a decent type system that actually gives useful types and useful errors if you have fixed points everywhere. So Haskell, for example, does fixed points to some extent, but has a really complicated type system to support it. And adding a type system to Nix that would be usable by casual users is almost impossible due to that. And so this gives yields the question of, can you exploit a type mismatch at runtime? Like, can you exploit a type mismatch to delay the rollout of an update in Nix packages, for example? Something that just triggers a type error just in certain conditions. Because you have a Turing complete system, it's obviously possible to engineer really nasty stuff deep into bash scripts or fixed points. They're there. And yeah, finally Nix packages is on Git. Cool, scales and all. But the bad point of that is that everything moves together. And I'm aware that there's a command in Git called rebase, but unfortunately it's not easy to have many different packages evolve independently. And I've tried it many times. And the rebases are painful, and as soon as you have a conflict, you're like, oh, okay, stop rebasing. A few examples of like bad security stuff. This is just public information, really. Hardening flags disabled on Linux and have been so for 10 years. So minus FPIE. So that's really, really, really bad for security folks. Curl minus K in fetch URL. The reasoning behind this is that we check everything. We check the outputs using hashes, so we don't need TLS, which is obviously flawed and wrong. So I had it fixed in Nix and in Nix packages because the problem appears in both. But someone reverted it with a self-approved PR 2 weeks later. For some reason, no explanation. Like I don't like that. No real sandboxing on macOS. So many companies these days run use macOS for security reasons, and that's a probably a good thing. But Nix is quite broken on macOS, and there's no real way to fix it. But that's not like fundamentally broken. It's just like macOS sandboxing is bad. And well, there's also the Devenv telemetry convinced me to start writing an alternative. Actually, that's the thing that triggered me, and I was like, okay, let's fuck that. Like, a self-approved PR in Nix packages that decides for everybody whether you should use telemetry. Like, no, that's it for me. So, and I know it's only about like one single package, but that's really bad. So some of these decisions are political, and I'm not talking about the drama surrounding the Nix community that's been surrounding Nix community in the like 2 years that touches some technical stuff, but also like world politics stuff, like Israel, for example. And so that I think that's like weird and off the point. But anyway, some things are political and technical at the same time. Like, for example, when you say good coders don't need type or borrow checkers because, you know, they are good C programmers, so they don't need any of that. They don't need any machine to assist them. Yet they're programmers and they don't need machines. So yeah, okay. So that's a broken reasoning, and fortunately it's dying fast. Even Linux has Rust now. It's like I think the Linux 7.0, which was released like a few days ago, has the first bits of Rust in it. So that's really cool, and it means like objective arguments are winning, and that's a really good stuff. Use C++ to write a purely functional language. That's a weird idea, I think. It was presumably for compatibility reasons, but there was already OCaml and Haskell that could have been used to do the exact same thing. Create your own language. Yeah, so creating language is fun, and we all love to do that. And I love writing compilers, and I've written tons of compilers. But you should only do that if you need something new in language design. If your language is just like, let's do just a domain-specific thing for my own need here. It will grow, but I don't really care about growth. So that's broken, because then you end up with like the most giant repository on GitHub, Nix packages, that's completely non-replaceable. Like, it's completely, like, rewriting Nix packages is just an impossible task. And that's not what I'm proposing here. Anyway, and so finally, a project meant for spreading and distributing knowledge and formalizing compilation recipes shouldn't have a BDFL or a flake designer, which are anyway. So we can do better. And now I'm going to talk about ELP, which is a project I started. So we still want to create bash scripts and run them in containers, because that's what Nix does. It's good at it, and it's a great idea. We want to use existing standards everywhere possible. So for example, in ELP, I have a Rust backend that compiles stuff in containers, and a front end that communicates with the backend using gRPC, so completely standard, plain gRPC, right? The front end is built using standard tools. So I evaluated 10 languages, 10 programming languages. I didn't want to write my own language, because that's what I didn't want to just, like, you know, do Nix, but write this time, like, do Gix. I love Gix as well, but Gix is like, yeah, the language is fucked. Let's do everything in my own language as designed, but I'm the good guy, so I designed it better. So I didn't want to do that. I wanted to use a standard language that already exists, already has a big community, or like big-ish community. So I evaluated lots of them. And for really deep technical reasons in language design, OCaml is the only one that fit the bill here. It already exists, and it's the best language for that particular job. Okay, I can talk about it for some time, maybe after this talk. And I wanted also, because I don't want to rewrite all of Nick's packages all by myself, because I'm not superhuman, I wanted first-class support for existing package repositories from existing Linux distributions. And one of the reasons for that is, well, pragmatism is one. And the other one is that these packages, if I design the language in such a way that they're really hard to override, meaning like you can, sure, you can import them, but then you just have to use them. You cannot just like change everything. This is actually, it sounds like a restriction, but it's actually a good property because you want to install those packages in a way that you can certify for a very large number of packages you're using in your system that they're vanilla, that they're the packages provided by Red Hat Enterprise Linux, for example. They've been audited. There is a secure like an insurance contract attached to them. And your system administrator or organization system administrator is happy about them. So that's one thing I want to do. And then if you want to override stuff, obviously we all love to override stuff. If you want to override stuff, well, then you have to rewrite the package. But then you'll have to rewrite it in a way that's like specific to your organization, right? And so this means that instead of like having this giant Nix packages and then have just a tiny little fraction of your own build code on top of that, I'm proposing to just like ditch most of that and have like plain Linux distributions and the tiny fraction of your code. Then when you want to audit either bash scripts or the OCaml code that creates the bash scripts, you just have to audit your own part. All right, so yeah, I already said most of that. Language hygiene is one thing that's really important. We want no fixed points, and we want a clean module and module separation. We don't want just like everything to depend on everything else. And we don't want this notion of dual scope or any like fancy new language ideas that end up being broken and can lead to unreadable code, or like not unreadable, but something worse, which is code you think you understand, but actually does something different from what you understand. Also, asynchronous syntax. So Nix has a version of that that's hidden in a weird way. So Nix does plan then do. And so because the hashes are known, because they're the hashes of recipes. And it's actually a substitute for asynchronous syntax, for an async await syntax. But that's, you know, in a weird way. And actually you can substitute the plan then do syntax with just async await, and it just works. And there's tons of languages already supporting it, and it's more efficient. Anyway, so front-end language, OCaml, so why? This is a weird choice, of course. Well, I'm French, so it's a little bit weird for me, but it's still quite weird. It has extremely fast compilation, so unlike Rust, and reasonable runtime speed. It has late bindings. In the Nix community, we call them overrides. And it's as far as I know, it's the only functional language that has late binding. It has a simple type system. So it's not super simple, but it's possibly the simplest type system of all the mainstream functional programming languages. And that's a really good property because it gives you clear error messages at compile time. And so before even sending anything to or generating any bash scripts, you can already tell that this code is not going to run. And it runs everywhere, sometimes using bytecode, but it runs on lots of different architectures and platforms. So that's a good property. The backend is written in Rust. It uses Linux namespaces to isolate builds. I'd love to run it on macOS using a different system than their sandbox, because it's obviously broken. And now they're saying, well, you shouldn't use sandboxes. You should use VMs instead. So maybe do something like that. But the executable format is different as well. So it needs a little bit of work to do that. It includes a super fast implementation of an ELF editing tool to relink Debian packages deterministically. So patch ELF in Nix is not used very often. So patch ELF doesn't need to be super fast. It's not the most important factor in build speed. Here it is. So I had to write something that's like much faster than patch ELF. And it's included in that. Resolution of Debian dependencies, obviously. So the Debian dependency language is Turing complete, or I think, or PSpace hard. Like anyway, it's like a really big complexity class, and it can already compile itself. So that's something really cool. Nix cannot even do that, by the way. Well, sometimes it can compile itself, but not on all platforms. Governance. So governance is hard, but some projects have figured it out. So Rust, for example. So the good point of this is that you don't need so much governance as in Nix packages, because it's not as massive. You can rely on other projects' governance, like Debian, Ubuntu, Red Hat, Arch, or whatever. And something that's really important for me is the concept of the walkaway stack. Walkaway stack is like something, it's a stack that's so generic that if it becomes toxic or polluted or bad, you can just walk away. You can just leave the room. And the person who explained this concept to me described it as like the air in communication. Something really cool about the air that we use. So we use the air to communicate, right? To carry sounds. And when a person becomes too loud in a room, one really good property of air is that it's everywhere on Earth. So you can just get away and go to another room. And fortunately, the sounds of a massive troll in the original room doesn't follow you. So that's something that Nix doesn't have, because Nix packages. Because if you wanted to change just a tiny bit of the Nix language, you would immediately run into this giant issue that all of Nix packages would be broken. So, yeah, if a package repository becomes toxic, or you don't like the build system that Nix is using, or it's signs partnerships behind your back with really bad defense companies or whatever, then you can just walk away and you can just bring your packages with you, because they're not fundamentally attached to your language. Obviously, there's this tiny layer of OCaml or whatever, because like you could also use other front-end languages, because in the end it's just using gRPC with let's 20 calls to the server. So you can just rewrite a different front-end if you want. You won't have to rewrite all the packages of the universe. Right, so thanks a lot. I don't know how much time I have left, because I've prepared a small demo.
You have approximately 3 minutes left.
3 minutes left? Oh, that's enough for a demo, obviously.
I mean, if you want to have QA, we should move to
maybe
QA.
So. Okay, almost. No. All right. So, let's do some Q&A while I prepare for that.
Do we have save time. Short question for each person? Very direct.
I don't quite understand what you mean by OCaml is the front-end language. I think you show it here. That's actually how you define the packages and the builds in OCaml.
Yeah.
Okay.
So this is an example of a package. So that's actually the example of it building itself. So there's just library here. So called rust.ml. I'm not expecting you to understand any of that syntax, but the thing is, so I wrote the ancestor to Crite to Nix, and also something called build rust crite, which is the Nix support libraries inside Nix packages to be able to compile crites in isolation. And so build rust crite itself is probably a few thousand lines of Rust code, plus a few thousand of Nix code. And build rust crite inside Nix packages is a few hundreds of lines of Nix. And this is much, much more succinct. All of that together, it's entirely written in this very file in 717 lines of code. So it's big, because Cargo is complicated and has tons of options, but also it works on any platform, which is not the case of any Rust, Rust to Nix solution that exists today in Nix packages, because they all have these weird quirks where you run Cargo metadata on one platform, but then compile on a different one, it's broken. Yeah.
So if we're using system packages for everything, then how do you patch those? Because one of the things I've dealt with, like working on Hermetic build systems at work, is that like we often find bugs in the system packages. And then if you have a big like discontinuity if you want to patch one. What do you do about that? Do you maintain your own package repo? Like, how do you handle that as an organization?
You would probably do the same thing as you do in Nix, which is you patch them locally. So that's already what you do with Nix, right? You patch them and try to upstream them in Nix packages and wait for the fixes to reach stable. So here you would probably do the build scripts, convert the build scripts in ELP, and write your own changes, and then maybe use that while your fixes or your patches haven't reached the package repositories. So it's kind of the same thing. It's just slightly less convenient because you have these two different, you have a mismatch between the two languages. Like one is ELP, the other one is a system package.
And you have a question over here.
Hi, so you gave several technical reasons for choosing OCaml as a front-end language, but there were also political concerns, and I'm thinking, what about the fact that, you know, OCaml is not a super big language, so it can become dominated by a few private actors such as GeneStreet or Meta. So what do you think of that?
Yeah, that's a totally valid concern. So your question, let me rephrase it, is like, is GeneStreet better than determinate systems? I don't know. Anyway, no, that's not a real answer. You're totally right. That's definitely a concern. So my answer to that is to work with Fabrice, who's here, who's the head of OCaml Pro, a French consultancy company specialized in OCaml. And so yeah, work with the experts and make sure that this doesn't happen. And so there are technical reasons. They're convincing enough to be like, I've implemented a version of this in Lua. It wasn't really Lua. It was like Roblox's version of Lua, which is how is it called? What? Lua something. It's like Lua. Yeah, it's really cool. It's really cool. They have a really fast bytecode compiler and stuff, but unfortunately, it doesn't have nominal types, which I really wanted here.
You said that async await is better than build than or plan than do, but
no. No? I said it's like plan then do is a form of async await.
But that means that you can't just output the entire plan without doing anything.
That's true. Yeah, and the reason it's actually for a good technical reason I didn't mention is that you want to build a Merkle tree of the hashes of the outputs of your packages, and not only of the inputs. And this prevents the mismatch between the hashes you have in the Nix archive, in the NAR files, and the recipes. Because actually, one thing you can do, Nix doesn't give you a good way of verifying that the output hash is what it claims to be. So for example, if you can tamper the Nix cache, you can just change stuff in the binary packages, and then there's no way to check that. And so if your build recipes use that downstream, you're like, okay, I use something that's not actually what I think it is. And so, yeah, but you know, you cannot have your cake and eat it all. Like Nix chose one way, which is perfectly reasonable and understandable, but it has security implications that mean that sometimes it's not great.
Fair enough.
I will give the mic first.
So you just specified that you aren't reifying the build plans because you believe this would conflict with content addressing. That
yeah.
Doesn't seem obvious to me, and it is not true for NixCADRV. It is merely that you have a like forward mode plan where you are learning the output hashes as you go. But the program essentially that does that is reifiable into a pretty small language,
right? But you can tamper with the Nix cache and change the output without changing the cache. So without changing the hash, and that's a problem. Like the thing is, you're learning that as you go, as you said. But the problem is, there's no way to prove that. Like there's no way to verify that downstream. So it's the same as in plain Linux distributions, right? Like in Ubuntu, you don't really know when you download the package. There's no way to know, except from recompiling the package, there's no way to know that the cache really corresponds to what it claims to be, right? So here it's kind of the same, except we're not using just build plans to hash the outputs. We're using the actual outputs of the build.
Yes, that doesn't get in the way of reifying that process itself. Merely the lack of knowledge of the output hashes doesn't mean you can't leave those as opaque forward references for later. You can, right, fundamentally, if you look at a trace of your builds, like, most of the structure of your build is not unpredictable. It is only those output hashes.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true, yeah.
Now, my actual question, which I meant to ask, was you've chosen OCaml, okay. You have various reasons for why picking a domain-specific language doesn't make sense. But the value of Nix is mostly in what it doesn't let you do, in particular.
Yeah,
absolutely. It is pure and deterministic. OCaml has notably like made some different choices, but do I have access to I/O, to entropy?
We can restrict. No, that's a really, really good question. So one of the reasons I didn't mention for the choice of OCaml is the existence of the bytecode language, and so you can run a virtual machine to make sure that first you can compile it without the standard library, or with a restricted version of that. We are not doing that yet, but we're working with OCaml experts to improve that situation, and also you can definitely, if you want, like, real actual certainty that you're not doing any, you're not having any side effects when evaluating the build plans, then you can definitely do that. Yeah, you can definitely compile your OCaml to a bytecode and then run the OCaml bytecode interpreter with restrictions. So no access to the file system, no access to the network, no access to I/O.
Okay, yeah, that was the bit I was particularly interested in.
Other languages do not let you, like, I've tried. So Lua lets you do that as well. But other languages, such as like Rust, for example, doesn't make that as easy, because STD is kind of important if you want to do cool stuff, like useful stuff. But it comes with all the I/O stuff that you don't want.
Thank you very much for all the questions. I invite you to extend this conversation at lunch or over the news. Big round of applause for Pierre-Etienne for this very interesting talk.